I'm Billy Merritt, and you're listening to Improv Nerd with Jimmy Corain.
Jimmy Corain's a nerd. Jimmy Corain's an improv nerd. Jimmy Corain's a nerd.
Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Corain, and you're listening to another episode of Improv Nerd, and we're sponsored today by acting coach Ryan Kitley here in Chicago. Now, if you're an actor, you want to say things like, my last audition was amazing, or I kicked ass every time in the room, or today at my callback, the producer gave me the role before I even finished the scene. Now, if you're not saying those things, you might want to get some coaching for your next audition. And I can speak from experience, getting a coach makes a difference. It helps you land the role. And nobody's better in helping you land the role than Chicago actor and coach Ryan Kitley. Ryan specializes in coaching actors for TV and film and theater auditions. Recent credits include Chicago PD, Chicago Fire, Empire, and the Goodman Theater. Visit RyanKitley.com or find him on Facebook. All you need to do is go to RyanKitley.com. We are also sponsored by the 4th Annual Chicago Women's Funny Festival. Now, Stage 773 presents the 4th Annual Chicago Women's Funny Festival, and it's happening June 18th through the 21st, with over 160 groups and solo acts presented on four stages over four funny-filled days. The Chicago Women's Funny Festival features all forms of comedy, including stand-up, sketch, solo, musical, vaudeville, and improv with comedians from across the globe. This year's lineup is amazing, and it includes SNL writer Katie Rich, stand-up performer Tamale Rocks, improv veterans Susan Messing and Rachel Mason, and solo performer seen on Comedy Central Kelly Howard. Shows, tickets, festival day passes, and the exclusive all-festival pass are now on sale at ChicagoWomen'sFunnyFestival.com. ChicagoWomen'sFunnyFestival.com. Also, if you find yourself here in Chicago in the month of July, I'm offering two Artist Low Comedy Weekend Intensives. They'll be 11th and 12th on July and the 25th and the 26th, where I'll teach you before you can be funny, you need to be real, and guess what? You're going to be even funnier. I limit this to 14 people. Spaces are still available. For more information, go to my website, my slick new website at jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com. We have a great show for you today. This is an epic show. I'm probably even downselling it right now. It's such a big show. Our guest today from the UCB, New York and LA now, Billy Merritt. Billy has been a performer, teacher, and director at the UCB Theater since it first opened its doors in New York City. He's been a founding member of the improv groups The Swarm and The Stepfathers in New York and The Smokes in Los Angeles. We talked to Billy about how he classifies improvisers, pirates, robots, ninja, and how he came up with the whole theory. We also asked him about what his definition of the game and the scene means to him, and nobody has given such a comprehensive deconstruction of the improv scene that Billy and I perform in this episode. You are going to love it. But before we get to that episode, I've been traveling a lot, teaching and doing Improv Nerd, as you probably can figure out with some of the episodes we've been bringing you lately, and which means I have to fly. And I get a lot of anxiety about flying. I get a lot of anxiety about a lot of things, but flying is something that always brings a lot of anxiety to me. And I was like, I want to get to the airport at least, and this is being conservative, an hour before. I really like to get there about an hour and a half. And I know it's sad. It's very sad that I operate like that, which is great, you know, if you're, you know, when you go to a busy airport like in Chicago or New York or L.A. But when you're on the other side, when you're like in Omaha or Columbus, Ohio, you don't need to be there an hour and a half, because there's small airports. You get through security, and then there's really nothing to do. So when Dylan dropped me off at Omaha, of course, you know, I was like, I got to get there an hour ahead. And I was there an hour ahead, and there was nothing to do. And the other thing that I do after I go on these trips and I'm dropped off at the airport, I always want to get myself a treat, something, maybe a book, you know, maybe a nice meal. But in the Omaha, I was going to say library, but in the Omaha airport, there was nothing. There was nothing except they had a stand that was selling Omaha steaks. They actually were, they had a promotion where they were giving these like 2 feet long beef jerky or beef sticks, which I had no interest in. But I was thinking, you know, it might be nice to bring a couple steaks home to Lauren because they freeze them and they make them, you know, easy to take on the airplane. But I was so turned off by the people that work there. They were so helpful and so enthusiastic and so positive that I don't trust that. So I just kind of walked away from it. I know I'm kind of screwed up that way, but if you want to sell me something, enthusiasm, being positive, and being helpful, usually you're not going to get the sale. Well, anyways, you are going to love this episode. Billy Merritt has so much to say about improv and his philosophies on improv. You are going to love this, the Billy Merritt episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah.
Classy.
It's very classy.
Yeah.
I never got to ask you what you were like as a kid growing up.
Precocious? No, not at all. You know, my mom loves saying this over and over. It's like, now I know why you watched all that TV. I didn't know that, but apparently I was a loner kid that watched a lot of TV.
What kind of shows did you watch?
You know what? I remember the first movies I used to watch over and over were Martin and Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
Old Duck Soup, Marx Brothers. Because I grew up at that age, I lived in Miami. Mm-hmm. Then I ended up going to Gainesville, moving up to Gainesville in my teen years and my college years. I also remember Gilligan's Island, Brady Bunch, Partridge Family. All those shows I used to watch religiously. And then I think comedy, the show that changed my life was Monty Python on PBS.
What was it about Monty Python?
It was weird. It was it was stupid, but it was well done. I mean, it was all the words were pronounced well. I mean, you could tell that these are really smart people acting stupid, and it kind of opened me up to go, oh, you know, you can do that. You're not just an idiot. You know, you can do it smartly and fun. It scared me at first. The naked guy in the piano the way it transferred from one scene to the other, because I didn't know how to end a sketch. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand that part, but, you know, I think I watched those shows over and over and over and had each sketch memorized. And then I looked for friends that had that, and we just say the same thing back and forth.
In high school, did you do any theater?
A little near the end. I was kind of like a university brat. My parents taught.
They were both professors.
Yeah,
right?
They were both professors. So we went from University of Miami up to University of Florida. And I went to the university high school there, which is great because it was like a perfect school on campus. I had a sociology teacher in high school, you know, so it was like very open and great. And the people there were very open, and it was such a small school that I got to be a jock, and I always wanted to be a jock, so because of my size, I finally got to play football and do that stuff.
Were you any good at it?
No.
Okay.
but this school had a clique of nerd jocks, so I learned how to play D&D on JV football.
So you'd be like studying plays, and then...
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So that was like a kind of a fun group right there. And then we, you know, as an elective, we took some acting classes. Then we all started kind of getting into it and messing around and having fun. But right after high school, I didn't do any theater for a while. I just kind of dropped off.
And then you got into improv.
Yeah, yeah. Later on, I went to college, tried to play football, did not work out at all. Got a degree in small business management. Thank you. Which means I can open up restaurants.
Right.
Is basically what it meant. So I worked in restaurant management and stuff like that. Just it was, you know, one of those spirally, not a fun life kind of thing. It's like, is this going to be my life? And it's
but you got involved in cocaine when you were there, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, do you know a lot of?
We talked before. Yeah, yeah.
I don't remember. I was in a cocaine haze.
Right.
cocaine.
Okay.
Well, I mean, if you're a restaurant manager in Florida, you are required. Part of your job is to do a lot of cocaine in the office.
Right.
Everybody does that. You work at Sizzler, you do cocaine. It just works all together.
Uh-huh. Was that part of the salad bar? Cocaine.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
That brass doesn't polish itself.
Right. Yeah.
You got a lot of all night long just right. polishing the
it's
brass.
Been there for 6 hours.
Yeah.
It's not
I know.
Shiny enough.
Those wings. Tastes good. But, you know, like all drugs like that do, it kind of turns into a horrible spiral.
Do you remember when you bottomed out on it?
Yeah, yeah. I did not show up to work. And I was a manager.
Okay.
And I just said, I can't do this anymore. You know, whatever money I was making was going out.
How much were you doing, would you say?
I don't know. I would say, first of all, I became creative. I've always been creative in some manner or form. So I fired myself as the head manager and made myself the head bartender, because the head bartender can make a lot of cash and embezzle a lot of cash.
Right.
So, I don't know exactly what the habit was, but it was like an all-night affair, you know. It was like I clearly would do, you know, some cocaine, serve a drink and go, it's time for some more cocaine. And I keep going back and forth. And it got to the point where if I kept this up, that would be it. You know, I would be that guy. And if you know anything about Florida, half the people are that. If you have retirees or you have people that are hanging around pawn shops trying to sell whatever they can. It's a very interesting, beautiful paradise place, but it's also incredibly depressing in that sense. So I just dropped everything, moved back in with my mom, loved it, she loved it.
And you're like 30 at this time,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, okay. Absolutely, I was nailing it at 30.
Okay.
And went back to school, and it's like, okay, reboot, let's go. And then that's where I literally discovered theater at this school that I went to down in Palm Beach State College. I had no idea about this, but some of the best acting teachers in Florida were in this little school area. Frank Leahy was the guy who influenced me, Michael Delaney, Burt Reynolds, Judge Reinhold, the big names in improv and acting.
Right.
This guy's been around forever, and he kind of took us under our wing, and it really felt... I don't remember the day I bottomed out as much as I remember the day I walked into the theater. I thought it was the cafeteria, so I was looking for food, as I'm wont to do. And then a gentleman, whose name is also Billy, a wonderful set designer who's passed away. It was the AIDS epidemic at that time, so unfortunately passed away. But he says, who are you? Take this. Break. Paint that. And I started painting the set to rags. He didn't even know who I was or what's going on. And that night I went to a rehearsal and I became a stage guy. And I left crying because it's like, oh my God, my life's saved. I know what I want to do, you know, and it was just so wonderful.
So you meet Michael Delaney.
Yes, he was there.
Okay.
First thing Michael Delaney ever said to me was, got any weed? And we became best friends.
Did you have any weed?
No, but my girlfriend at the time did.
Okay.
And we became really good friends. You know, I don't do cocaine, but I did smoke pot. I'm not, you know, I'm not an idiot. And he became that buddy that we would take acting classes together. We became theater nerds. But then we would go home and we'd smoke pot and watch SCTV. And he had bookcases full of all cassette tapes of SCTV. And I knew a lot of it, but I didn't know as much as he did. We almost challenged each other, and we watched everything. And he had gone to, as a kid, driven up to Chicago to see SCTV or to see Second City. Yeah. And anytime there was a Torco, we would go and do road trips and watch it. So we were just infatuated with that. Never thinking that we would do improv, but it was just our big something that we loved. But we were doing plays, we were doing musicals. In regular plays. The very first play I ever did was Gemini, which is not funny at all.
Right. I don't know it at all.
Yeah. You don't need to know it.
Okay.
It's not important. It's a really good, intense play, and it's a lot of fun. And Delaney was in it, too. So we got really caught up in doing that. I think it was the fall serious play, spring musical, always a spring musical. And Delaney and I and a couple other friends of ours that kind of like this stuff did a musical called The Mystery of Edwin Drood, written by Rupert Holmes, who also wrote the Pina Colada song.
If I got pina colada.
We know it.
Yeah.
In that show, our director had us, and I think that's the element of the show, is we are playing Victorian actors who are playing Dickinsonian characters. So we're playing characters within characters, which we thought really deep. Uh-huh. So what he had us do is go out 15 minutes before showtime mm-hmm. as these Victorian characters and improvise and, right. and do that. And that's the first time I did anything like that. And it was, sadly, it was like another cocaine buzz. It was like, oh man, this is awesome. I love this. This is what I wanted to do.
So then you and Michael, there's a period now yeah. where you do bad improv, right?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
How bad was it? You say it lovingly.
Oh, I love. Well, I mean, that was our training. That's where right. we sharpened our teeth on it. It was in West Palm Beach. There was no place to play. Mm-hmm. We knew some friends who had a jazz bar. Who doesn't? Mm-hmm. Every other friend has a jazz bar called the Arts Bar, and they gave us an 11 p.m. slot on Sunday, mm-hmm. which they would normally be closed.
Right.
And we did a show. It was so bad. It was games, short form games, and mm-hmm. sketches. Our first two sketches were stolen mm-hmm. from SCTV, that's SCTV, from Second City.
Okay.
And
nobody,
I didn't know it. Right. Delaney wrote it, and I went, really, this, okay.
Right.
But it got us up on our feet, we started playing, we got, you know, people starting to come see our shows, and it got that little community feel and that edge. And we felt, that became our main goal. So acting kind of took a side swipe to doing improv, doing that show. Then we did two shows a week, three shows a week. Now my favorite thing is the name of the group.
What was the name of the group?
We fought over the name. We were okay. the troupe with no name for a half a year because okay. we kept arguing. But eventually we became the Comedy Squad.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that a great name?
It's an awesome great name.
Comedy, just the laughs, ma'am.
Okay.
That was our
I got it. I got it.
I don't think you got it. Okay, you get it.
I got it. So then when did you and Delaney decide we're going to move up to New York?
I guess it's that big fish, small pond kind of thing. Uh-huh. I mean, we had nobody teaching us, and we were doing it on our own. And if we kept doing it on our own, it would be not good for mm-hmm. a long time. And one of the things that happens, I feel, in local comedy groups like that mm-hmm. is we can get very territorial with your comedy. You can, like, you know, those guys down in Miami don't know what funny is. We know, because comedy's subjective.
Right.
And we were still actors. You know, I had a job doing theater tech and uh-huh. stuff like that. And we were trying to go, do we want to go to Chicago and go the improv route, or do we want to go to New York and do the improv acting route?
Mm-hmm.
Delaney's now wife, but girlfriend at the time, got a scholarship to the Neighborhood Playhouse in New York.
Mm-hmm.
So she moved up, and now he wanted to go there, so he moved. So I followed him with some other guys,
mm-hmm.
And we all went to New York that way. And what actually sold us was we found out that there was a school and comedy theater called National Improv Theater,
mm-hmm.
Which we knew nothing about. The teacher for that theater was Tamara Wilcox. She was on a committee a long time ago.
In San Francisco?
Yeah, yeah, New Dell. So we went up there and we trained under her. And it wasn't gameplay, it wasn't Harold's, but it was kind of an in-betweenish kind of improv. It was really good. It was really good.
So you're with the National Improv Theater.
Yeah.
And you're doing some short form, right, and some montage kind of
yeah,
stuff,
yeah.
scenic stuff. And then one night, you go to a bar,
yeah.
and you see the original four UCB
yeah.
do Ass Cat
yeah.
in a bar.
Yeah.
This is before they even have a space.
No.
How
yeah.
did that change the way you looked at improv?
It was literally, oh, that's it. I want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
The feeling I had for Monty Python, it's like, oh, I love that kind of comedy. That's my thing. That's what I felt when I saw what they were doing and how they were doing it. I can't put my finger on it exactly. Nobody was a name, so it's not like these are stars or we're starstruck or anything. In fact, if you know Matt Besser, he was the first person I did a workshop with. He's a little abrasive, so
right.
it's not like he's a fun guy to hang out with. He's brilliant. But the first meeting with him, you're going, what the fuck? You know, what's going on? But to see that show working together, I don't know exactly what the scene was, but there was some sort of scene going on. It was when Hillary Clinton was doing It Takes a Village,
mm-hmm.
and they were doing some sort of group game where a whole village was chasing down a child,
mm-hmm.
And they became like just a series of serial murdering villages or something like that. And I went, oh yeah, okay, that's what I want. That's the kind of comedy I want to do. And we talked to them afterwards. We found out they were doing workshops and started doing those with them.
And you started doing workshops, and you trained with all four original.
Yeah.
And you said you Besser was kind of a challenge for you.
Yeah.
And you left that first workshop feeling kind of discouraged.
Yeah. Because he's the first person to go, I think literally he said, you're improvising with blinders on. And no one's ever criticized me in my improv before, which they should have done. You know, you should have gotten that. I have a pet peeve with 101 teachers or brand new teachers who say everything is great that you're doing, because that doesn't set you up for the rest of your improv. You got to be, you know, help steered a little bit. And that's what he did. So that he was the first person to, you know, say that. And I walked away in a huff. But he was right, you know. After I calmed down, I said, well, yeah, okay, you're right.
Now, when you hear that, you're like, oh, I'm going to quit? Or did you, how did you?
I wanted to prove him wrong.
Okay.
I wanted to prove him that I know what you're saying. I know what this is. Mm-hmm. So I kind of treated it as, I guess there's like a jock mentality of, oh, yeah, well, let's see it. You know, I'll show you how to do it. And I think that got me motivated. Then I started taking workshops with all of them, and I got the idea that what amazes me about the four of them were they come from different schools of thought,
mm-hmm.
totally different attitudes, totally different approaches, yet they work so well together as a group. And that's what got me hooked onto it. That's what amazed me.
How did your short-term improv experience help you now that you were doing UCB into long form? Because a lot of people are like, oh, short form, you know, whatever. But you'd studied for a while.
Yeah.
Short form.
You learn to be quick. You learn to be smart. You learn to do all the technique that helps you work on improv philosophy. I still encourage, you know, I don't encourage people to go do short form, but if you're in my class and you're short form, I'm going, great. You're going to be great at group games. You're going to be great at doing slideshow or quick narratives or doing just those little techniques that changes up the show and makes it a little bit more interesting. So you're definitely honing sharp tools in short form. It helps you in your long form.
Now, so you're there. So you're in UCB.
Yeah.
You then become you're on the Swarm and then mm-hmm. the Stepfathers,
yeah.
which are two legendary Herald teams there
yeah.
in New York. And then you start teaching mm-hmm. as well. And you have a reputation for bringing fun and joy to your class.
That's bullshit.
You think it's bullshit?
No. Yeah. It is.
Okay.
Yeah. I. You know what?
Because
I feel
you are
evolved.
Such a joyful person.
I am. I absolutely feel like it's a stand-up comedy set at times, and I do want to have fun because it is fun.
Mm-hmm.
Follow your joy, follow your fun. This should be fun.
Mm-hmm.
But while it's fun, I'd also like to say that what I saw there was pure shit. But let's make it fun. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it allows me to criticize people, yet kind of pull back a little bit. I like to say every now and then in class, just stop everybody once we get in our heads and go, hey, isn't this fun? Let's relax a little bit, you know, and then I'll make a fart joke and everybody will be happy.
Were you always a fun and joyful person?
Yes, I think so. I think it's one of those, I was an only child, so I think there's that, there's a lot of improvisers who are introverts in social life,
mm-hmm.
but extroverts on stage.
Mm-hmm.
I clearly fit into that mold
mm-hmm.
of I'm more quiet and I watch things, I watch what's going on around me outside of improv, but once I get there or when I'm with people or with a crowd, I put on whatever that facade is, you know.
Now, Will Hines, who's a good friend of yours,
yeah.
and I love Will. He's been so great to me and the podcast here. He said, as a teacher, you are the teacher that gives students confidence.
Yeah.
How do you do that? Because I'm a guy who struggles with confidence
yeah.
after all these years.
Because I absolutely, the fact that you take the class is all you need to do for me. You know what I mean? You've proven to me that you want to do this. And the beauty of improv, and I think I learned this a long time ago, no matter who's on, I don't know how to put it, without saying the word train wreck.
Okay.
There are times when people will be on stage and go, this person's a train wreck. To me, I'm going, right now, you're a train wreck, but I have had experiences in my past where I've seen people like you blossom. So I'm going to believe in you, and I know you're going to get better. I know I wasn't that great when I started, and I'm constantly self-critical of myself. So, and I think it was, I actually got a lot of soothing quotes from Del Close that really helped me with this. One of them being, he really enjoyed people who had life experiences in his class. I don't know if it was Walsh or somebody was telling me that, and it's like, oh, thank God, because I got those. And usually in classes, it's those people with life experiences who kind of have the harder problem. The people in their 30s or 40s sometimes We'll have a problem in the class, especially filled with 19-year-olds.
Right.
But those are the ones that I want to embrace.
What I found is those older people, it's hard to pull their... They don't want to share their life experience,
yeah.
And that's their strength.
Yeah.
So how do you get the life experience out of that 30 or 40-year-old who's so worried that they have to play like the 19-year-old?
I think they have to get it out once. And this is something, if we're talking... Besser did this with me. He made me do a monologue during an ASCAP once, and it was a story I never gave out. It's too long a story to tell, but it was basically about me being in a bar fight, and somebody accidentally kicked me in the stomach, and I shit my pants in the middle of it. I was a bouncer at that time, and you're not supposed to shit your pants as a bouncer.
Right.
But as I told the story, the entire audience was like, and just laughing and in shock and all this stuff, and I could feel this going over me. And then right after the show, Besser gave me a smile and says, "Feels good, doesn't it?" And it's like, yes. If I can get some of these older people to get those stories out, I think that they're going to feel better, and they're going to tell another story and another story.
When I'm honest on stage like that, I feel a tremendous amount of shame and vulnerability.
Really?
Did you feel that, or were you more high off the laugh?
It started there. No, yeah, maybe the laugh was a salve.
Mm.
It made me feel better. Because I didn't know I was going to tell this story. It just came out, and it's like, well, now's the time. I, like, literally have never told the story in my life. It was a private humiliation.
Well, it's something you had a lot of shame, and you were burying it down there.
And I guess I didn't even hear the laughter till the end. Mm-hmm. And then in retrospect, I kind of picked up on it. And it's not like now I'm going to tell all my shit stories, which I have a lot of. But it's just being truthful and honest was what it really hit me. You know, I don't know why I didn't feel shame after that. That's weird. I don't know.
You know, it's interesting because, you know, you hear like an ASCAT and Armando and stuff like that. The monologuist tells... He's honest,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
How, you know, I've always wondered how that affects the scenes.
I don't know. You know what? I was talking to somebody about it. Every now and then an ASCAT will have a stand-up comic and you know they're doing their act. You can feel it. Or like I have one guy, not me, but I sat in on several ASCATs. I don't sit in on a lot, but the same person told the same story again and again. And it's like, this is your act. This isn't real. And for some reason... Sure, you can pull something off of it, but it's not. There's no grounded truth in it, and I can't put my finger on it, but you just know. And it's all about reality and scene work, and how truthful can you be? And don't be afraid of what it is. Get it out there and see how the audience reacts. I think there is a stronger empathy connection between the stage and the audience the more truthful you can be. And you don't have to be funny. You just have to be truthful. That's something that I've learned lately. Best monologist that I ever sat through in an ASCAP was in New York was Gideon Yago.
I don't know.
Anybody remember Gideon Yago? Nobody? Of course not. It was in the 50s. What?
I think he's from Omaha, isn't he?
Is he? Come on, guys. He's from Omaha. Gideon Yago was a correspondent for MTV in his younger days. Then he started doing some other stuff like Vice and stuff. But he had just come back from somebody in the audience. It was right after the tsunamis. Mm-hmm. And somebody in the audience thought it would be hilarious to suggest Flotsam and Jetsam. Which, come on. And he said, well, I just came back from Indonesia. And he took that whole stage. And usually a monologue is maybe 3-4 minutes and we do improv. His monologue, or it wasn't even a monologue, it was a story that lasted for 20 minutes. And we sat down on the floor and just listened to him. He told that whole story about everything that was going on, and we just took a breath. And Amy just said, and now comedy. And we just went up, and it just relieved the whole room. And it's like, I realize you're going to find comedy. Don't be afraid of the tragedy. Play through it. It's going to be better. It's going to be a bigger laugh at the end.
And that was Amy Poehler who said that, right?
Yeah, uh-huh.
What was working with Amy like? Because
I learned a lot. She was our first director. She was responsible
for the Swarm.
We were all in separate groups from New York. The members of the Swarm were really the only team. We didn't get our chops at UCB. We got chops elsewhere. We trained elsewhere, and then we came to them. The next generation grew up through the UCB system. So we had a lot of baggage, whatever that means. Amy wanted to try this new form. to protect her. I won't tell you about it. It didn't work out. It involved cassette tapes of Wu-Tang Clan.
Okay.
We'll move on. So she picked the whitest people in New York to do the form. And half of us were in one indie group, and the other half were another. Myself, Michael Delaney, and Dave Blumenfeld were in one group. The two Andys, Andy Secunda, Andy Daly, and Sean Conroy were over at Chicago City Limits. And I think it was Secunda and Delaney that kind of became friends, and they knew Amy, and Amy said, can you get a group together? So we got them, Ian Roberts' wife, Katie Roberts, was also on our team. I credit her for making us the team we are, because she's the only one. She's the only one that was played the straight person for the longest time. And our first meeting was in Amy's apartment, where she handed us the cassette tapes and started working on this new form. That didn't work out great, but we learned to play with each other, we learned to like each other, and we just morphed into a Herald team from there.
What did you learn from that experience of like, okay, here's this form, it's based on cassette tapes.
Yeah.
I'm probably not really into it, I'm probably judging
it. Yeah. I think I need to explain it a little bit more.
Okay.
It's it's based on, can you do an improv set, a form, that is like a rap set. So if you listen to Wu-Tang's, what's the album on that cassette tape, guys? Yeah, that one. If you listen to that, you listen how if each song were a scene and you can sample the scenes together, can you create new scenes?
Right.
So her idea was brilliant. We were not the people to do that
right.
for him, so.
But a show that doesn't work out,
yeah.
What's the learning lesson for the group?
We learned what our strengths were, mm-hmm. and we learned what our strengths weren't. We became the swarm because that was one of her techniques that we would do. I want you to swarm the stage and describe everything as quickly and as fast mm-hmm. as you can. And it's like, oh, we're really good at this. And we eventually, our name came from that idea. We did not do well in the form, but we found out what we were good at, and we had this bond with each other, and it's not like we were all best friends and we went bowling right away, but we had a respect for each other that we wanted to challenge each other to get better.
Mm-hmm.
I very rarely have been with a group that's been that way, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? We're family, we're tight. I call Michael Delaney my improv wife because I've known him for 20 years. I won't see him for a year, I'll get on stage tomorrow and we'll be in sync with each other. But there are other people on the team like Sean Conroy, very good friend. I see him maybe once a month when we perform, but we're cued in with each other. We're synced in with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's what we learned. We're not good at this, but this is what we are good at. Let's do this.
You're also very famous for the improv theory, Pirates, Robot, Ninja.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Nothing. I just made it up. it comes from... I use those terms because they're fun terms, and everybody loves pirates, robots, and ninjas.
Mm-hmm.
It really comes from...
You love ninjas.
Yeah, yeah.
What's the love of ninjas?
I love ninjas. Well, who doesn't, number one? I did a form called the Ninja Form.
Mm-hmm.
There's a group in here. I just did a workshop where I had to do a little bit of it. The more you study ninjas, the more fun it is because they're all about true balance. It's just as noble to run away than it is to kill. And to kill something is to love something. So there's such a balance, a yin-yang in how they perform
mm-hmm.
And what they do. It's like you can take that and you can use that for mm-hmm. Herald teams. The idea of pirate and robot is left side of the brain, right side of the brain. All creativity takes the analytical side of your brain and the impulsive side.
Mm-hmm.
The analytical is about rules. And when I say all creativity, art, dance, anything that takes anything to be creative, you need to know the numbers, you need to know the tactical part of it, and learn that and do the work. But you also have to have that fuck your fear kind of attitude of throwing yourself out there like a pirate and not knowing what's next. And the purpose of the class is to find out, well, where do you lean towards? Are you more of a robot-y kind of person, or are you a pirate person? Do you think if somebody has a problem with getting in their head too much in a scene, that's not a bad thing. That means you're thinking through scenes too much. You just need to define that a little bit more and make your robot a little bit better. The idea is find out what kind of improviser you are, strengthen that so you can work on the other and balance them out, because you need both sides in order to create on stage or to create anything.
Is there an improviser out there that is all three?
Yes. The idea, that's your goal. It's either one or the other. The idea is attack a scene like a pirate, analyze a scene like a robot. Edit a scene like a ninja.
Mm-hmm.
Make all those moves that you can't be seen. The idea is if you have total control of both sides of your brain, you become the ninja. So the ninja is the the end piece. That's where you want to get to. And I feel anybody who's improvised long enough has that ninja quality. In other words, you're on stage, and if you've been on stage long enough and you realize, we need some more energy out here, I need to do something to break it up, that's your pirate. Or you're feeling we're all over the place, we need to ground this into some sort of reality. And what I've discovered is different groups, I'm a different person. In the Swarm, I'm a straight up pirate. I'm all over the place, they had to rein me in. Whereas on the Smokes in LA, I tended to be more of the robot and kind of fed other people because I'm older and tireder. But also, it just, that felt like that was my role in that group.
So let's talk a little about, the game and the definition of the game at UCB. Yeah. And this was interesting when we talked, you said everybody comes, first of all, it's a misconception, the game.
Yes.
Can you explain that?
When somebody mentions game, and
it's associated with UCB.
Yeah. UCB style game is premise based. Right. It's all about premise. And I'm going, no, it's not. The first 4 weeks in 101 and 201 have nothing to do with premise whatsoever. It's all about who you are and where you are. And the whole idea behind it is you must have that reality base, that truth, and feel totally comfortable in the who and where you are so that the unusual appears and then you can make that the game. Not the funny appears, the unusual appears.
But what you're really talking about is acting, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
And that's the other aspect. If you see a series of shows at UCB, you see slow play, organic, and you see premise-based. ASCAT's premise-based. Facebook, the show Facebook, very premise-based. Anything where you're interviewing the audience and you're taking ideas or stories, kind of you're finding premises off of that with the UCB game. But then there are shows like The Smokes. We just get a word and we go. We do a three-scene deconstruction type form. Or a soundtrack where we take audiences' music and they don't even know what music's going to play. And the rhythm gets them into the scene. Brian Gallivan is in that group, mm-hmm. along with a couple other people. And that's a fun form to do. So I try to tell my students, don't watch one or two shows. Watch all the shows that you can and kind of get the idea of how you can play your game.
Mm-hmm.
And that connects back to Pirate Robot. That idea is find out what kind of improviser you are, then plug that into the kind of improv you want to do. And that's what I did when I saw ASCAT. I said, that's what I want to do. That's the style of improv that I want to play.
But The Swarm was more like slow, let the game come to you. Can you explain that?
We have to remind her, we still do shows every now and then, old man shows, and we bring it back. We have to remind ourselves.
Now, are you all seated for this?
Hmm? Yeah.
You're seated, you're not getting up?
No. That's actually one of the moves is if we run out of ideas, let's get two chairs, let's get in a car, and let's drive to a scene.
Right.
And we just start driving. And if it's Sean and I, it's always a tiny car because that's always funny to drive in a tiny car.
Is Sean big too?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm bigger, trust
me. Right, okay.
But his beard, he's like Rasputin now.
Right.
There's a confidence and comfortability knowing that you don't have to go in with an idea of a scene. You just have to work with each other and know that between the two of you, you will discover the game.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like we said at the beginning of the Swarm's run, we're going to do it slow play. It's just what our personality wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
We're also a very argumentative group with philosophies. In other words, we'll get going. We can just start a scene fishing. Somebody will say something and it's always Secunda going, well, I don't know if I agree with that. And it becomes, and it's not, I disagree with you. It's, I disagree with you and this is why.
Mm-hmm.
And then we build on philosophy. And this is big with Amy Poehler. She taught us all the time, philosophize, guys. Don't say no. Say no, and this is why. So that your scene partner can have a logical argument with you. And as you're arguing, you're finding out who you are a little bit more.
So tell me, for people that are going, well, wait a second. That's not agreement.
But we, it is and it isn't.
Okay,
yeah.
So explain that.
How do I explain it? We agree to argue.
Okay.
Does that make sense? We agree that we're different people and that we're going to bicker for the rest of our lives. Are there people like that out there that are married for 80 years that constantly argue? Yes, they're wonderful people. They're known as Secunda's parents, actually.
Right. Well, come on. You can't be on an improv group where that doesn't happen backstage.
Yeah, right. You know? I mean, the great thing about The Swarm is we were never that group that just loved and hugged each other.
Mm-hmm.
We never argued. We never out and out argued. But if you ask each member of the Swarm what our show was about, you'll get a different answer from each of us. I don't know how to describe that.
But you also said something interesting, too, about if you asked a different person who teaches at UCB,
yes,
they're going to have a different take on what the game is.
I feel they do, and I think they need to. I think a uniform description of game, I just don't believe that that's possible. I can't do it, so I don't believe anybody else can do it. It's in the book. You know, you can hear certain people say this, and we get the gist of it. Usually when I'll start an advanced class, I'll ask each person, what do you think the game is? And it kind of, create a reality base, know who you are and where you are, find the unusual thing, call it out, justify it, if that, then what else, if that, then what else. That's the pattern. But there's so many different ways to play that, and so many, it could be a character. The person themselves could be a game. The relationship between them could be the game. Where they are, the heat and the weight of the scene, the location could be what the game is. A haunted house is a game, in a sense. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So you have to, and I learned that from Armando.
Armando Diaz.
Yeah, he was our second director after Amy. And,
right.
And he took over, and he literally said, a game could be this. A game could, in Armando's, game could be this.
Right.
And like 3 hours later, he said two more sentences.
Right. But he's one of those guys who can say very little and get a lot out of people.
Everything. I got a lot out of that. That's what that was my interpretation. I think the Swarm was very lucky to have three great teachers, Amy, Armando Diaz, and then Kevin Mullaney.
Mm-hmm.
And the three of them, I think a lot of my teaching comes from Kevin Mullaney. A lot of my philosophy maybe comes from Amy. But my interpretation of game or my relaxation into game comes from Armando.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, don't kvetch about the game. Don't worry about the game. The game is always there. And that kind of is what slow play for the Swarm was. We know we're going to get to the game. It could be at the beginning. It could be at the very beginning. A great show to me would have a very quick-paced game in one scene, a slow gameplay in another scene, one scene that doesn't even have a game at all but just has a weird conversation that you connect later on in the show, and then it's like, oh, there is a game there. It all comes back. And it's like, don't worry about it. It will stay calm, carry on. You're going to find the game.
And speaking of game, now we are going to improvise.
Yes.
So we haven't really talked about what we want to do.
No.
We got about 10 minutes.
Okay. You know what? I was doing something with a group today that I haven't done the scene in a long time. Have you ever done a confession scene?
No.
It just starts out as a regular scene.
Okay.
And you get a rhythm and go, and you know who you are and where you are, or
right,
something like that. And in the middle of it, somebody just confesses something to you that you don't expect.
Okay.
It's a great exercise to kind of inject a game into a scene.
Okay.
Or the note is, when in doubt, drop a bombshell.
Right.
This is something you don't want to do all the time. It's just something to play around
so
with.
It's a tool to have in your back pocket.
Exactly.
Okay,
exactly.
Great. Okay, so we're going to do that.
Yeah.
So one of us during the scene will confess something.
Yeah.
Okay, so what are we going to start with?
Get a suggestion, and let's just work out who we are and where we are from there.
Okay, great. And we'll call the scene.
Yeah.
Either one of us.
Oh, can we do, you know what my favorite scene is?
What is your favorite scene?
Oh, gosh. I love long chair scenes, like at a long table, where you're at one end of the table and I'm at the other end of the
sure,
table.
Sure, sure.
It's a real long table.
Sure.
I do one of those per show.
Okay. I did research on you, but I did not find that.
It's a secret.
Okay, it's not on Wikipedia. It's not in your bio on the UCB website.
Check it next year. I'm going to work on a new form.
Okay, that would be good.
Long table,
yeah,
long form.
Okay. Okay, so you want to do a long, you want to do,
yeah, please.
Okay, great.
And then
what is it about it that you like that?
Because it can go anywhere. It can, you can play all sorts of, The Prodigal Son Returns, Downton Abbey, those classes, upstairs, downstairs. You can have the butler going between them. There's something about distance.
So we don't, because when you said that, my initial thought was, okay, we both have to be sitting in chairs,
yeah,
on the long table.
But yeah.
You're saying that's not the case.
What do you mean I'm saying that's not the case?
You're saying if I was your butler,
I wouldn't
be sitting in the chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I see what you mean. Here's what I'll do. I'll set up a long table scene. It's like, okay, we've done a bunch of scenes. We're about 20 minutes into the show. We're running out of ideas. I'm going to put chairs on either end of the stage, and we're going to sit down, and we're going to start eating. But we have a whole, since it's a two-person scene, we're here.
Right.
But if it's like a crew on your back wall, somebody could come in as an old butler or something,
okay,
like that. But we've also done that where the butler, you know what, let's find out.
Let's find out. Okay, so could we have a suggestion, please, for this long table scene?
Jellyfish.
Jellyfish is the
thing. This is going to be awesome, guys. It's faced this way. So, you've watched enough TV, son. Just sit and have dinner with your pop.
Well, Dad, it's just the last episode of The Simpsons.
The last episode?
Well, I'm binge watching it, yes.
It's been around for years. It'll be around for years. I may not be around for years. Think of me as your last episode of Simpsons.
All right.
How was your day at school?
It was fine.
It was fine?
Yeah.
Was it?
No, I didn't go.
You didn't go to school?
No. Jeff?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jeff and I, we went to a baseball game instead.
Jeff Vicksburg?
Yeah, Jeff Vicksburg.
You went to a baseball game instead of school?
Yes.
And how do you think that's going to help you in your future, son?
Well, I kept the score and stuff like that.
What does that do? How does that make you a better person? We go to school to learn, to be a better person. I'm sorry. I just don't want what happened to me to happen to you.
Becoming a successful businessman?
I wasn't always a successful businessman. When I was younger, before I met your mother, I was a lady boy. Eat your ham.
Wait, Dad. What's a lady boy?
You don't know what a lady boy is?
No, I don't know what a lady boy is.
Well, when you're younger in your years, like you are, you tend to have more feminine-like features until you grow into your body and your skin and you look a little more masculine. People would pay me to make myself look more feminine, then I would go over to their houses and I would clean. I don't want that to happen to you, son. Son?
I...
Did you go to the ball game today?
No, I didn't. I went over to the Johnsons, and I vacuumed. And Dad, they gave me
$10. $10?
$10 to vacuum.
How long did you vacuum for?
For 4 hours.
You asked for more money, son. No, you don't. No. You don't need to do that.
Dad, the thing is, I really liked it.
You liked it?
I like cleaning.
It is kind of fun, isn't it?
Yeah. They have thick carpeting, and they have two dogs, and the dog shed.
What kind of vacuum cleaner did they use?
An Orbit. One of the best.
Oh, that is an excellent vacuum
cleaner. It has such great suction. I couldn't believe it.
What were you wearing?
They asked me to wear a housecoat, and I felt a little shame about it.
Mm.
But I did it anyways.
After we eat, I'm going to take you up to my room. I want to show you a closet of mine. If this is who we are, this is who we are.
So I didn't do anything wrong, did I?
No, you did what we do. We come from a long line of family of ladyboys.
It's between us, right? I'm not going to tell Mom, right?
No, that's the last thing you want to do. She doesn't need to know.
Okay.
And stay away from her makeup.
I'll put this stuff back. It's just lipstick and a little blush. I didn't think she would mind because she's got so much up there.
All right. When she sleeps tonight, she takes a lot of codeine now. I'll put that back into her makeup case. Son, if you need makeup, you can talk to me.
I just didn't know how to approach it.
Watching The Simpsons is not the way to do it.
Well, I was just doing it to get your attention. I don't really like The Simpsons.
I love you, son.
I love you too, Dad.
Let's hurry up and eat this ham and put on some dresses.
Okay. What did you think?
I have no idea where Lady Boy came from. And I don't want you to think I looked at you and thought Lady Boy.
No, no, no. If I did, I would say thank you for the compliment. So you said Lady Boy. You don't know where it came from.
I don't know at the moment where it came from. The fun thing about this kind of improv is as I go home, I'm going, what the fuck was that about?
But did you know, like, after you said it, like, okay, now I'm going to have to justify what it means? Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And now I throw myself out there. My pirate is going, Lady Boy, deal with it.
Right.
Fall and figure out what you do on the way down, right?
Right, Del Close.
So now that we've thrown that out there, now I got to reach for it.
Right.
Logically add it up. My robot's going, if I was a lady boy, why would I be a lady boy? I didn't have money, and then it kind of built from there.
Right.
Also, though, in the side of my head, I feel, and this happens in improv a lot, especially as you see so many shows, it's like, have I seen something like this before? Has this come from somewhere? Has anybody heard lady boy humor before? I feel there's a sketch out there that involves lady boy.
Well, when you said it, I thought, like, I should know what it meant.
Yeah.
But I didn't, and I'm like, okay, let's figure out what it is.
You know, it was a YouTube video of actual ladyboys that I was watching.
Okay. Now, do you feel shame about that, that you saw that, or?
No.
Okay, great. Okay, so let's analyze, let's break the scene down.
Okay. We established, when you were facing outwards, instead of facing me, what were you imagining? Were you imagining we'd both be facing outward and then looking at each other?
Yes, and that? I was like, okay, we're going to eat. I didn't know what we were going to eat, but I'm going to start eating because that's...
There are no mistakes, there's only gifts. That makes sense to be looking out there. But I figured, why is he turned out there? I must justify it. He's watching TV. Turn and face me, son.
Right.
And that immediately made me go, grumpy old man.
Okay.
You know, obviously there's a status thing going on with the table, right? Mm-hmm. So I always, you know, I'm figuring this out now, that I always take the high status at that table.
Right.
And I'm always eating. I always like to have a good meal during the show. Notice it was ham today.
Yeah.
I don't usually have ham on stage. So as soon as you turned, I immediately knew what our relationship was, right?
Okay.
But that doesn't mean we stop there. We keep building on it.
Mm-hmm.
The relationship is son who's not interested in being here right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's real, and that's going on all over the world everywhere. There
are
kids that would be rather watching TV than talk to their dad. So that, to me, is truthful and real, and we can play off of that.
At that point, I didn't know where we were going. And
yeah.
I'm like, I'm not giving him enough. That's, you know, that's what was going on with me. At the beginning of it.
Yeah. I mean, that's where you want to be, I feel.
Mm-hmm.
If we're dealing with different groups. And I think the Smokes does this, too. It's that slow play up front. Don't know where you are. Just exist together.
Right.
Feel the rhythm with each other. And then all of a sudden, you're going to figure it out.
It's almost like we bumped into it.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
And trust that you'll bump into it.
Right.
You'll always bump into something.
Okay, so we go back and forth, and then what happens?
Where are we? So you were upset. Oh, you said you were going to the game, right? All, this exercise, that's why Lady Boy came up, because I've got to throw out a confession that should be non sequitur to the scene.
Okay.
To shake it up. That's
okay.
The whole idea behind this exercise. So it shouldn't be the confession of, I didn't go to school. Did you feel that was the confession? I didn't go to school?
No, I didn't. I felt you were doing the confession.
When I said Ladyboy or before then?
The Ladyboy stuff.
Yeah, that was
the confession.
Clearly the confession,
you know. At that point, I was just trying to keep up with you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Once I get on Ladyboy tear, just follow me.
Right,
just
okay.
Get on the boat. Let's go down that alley. To me, that confession is still real, and then the beat, the rhythm of the scene.
Mm-hmm.
I watched Simpsons. I don't want to eat with you. I didn't go to school. I went to went to the ball game.
Right.
With what's his name?
You named it. I forget.
I named it after a Civil War battle, so
okay.
I can remember it. And now I don't remember the name. Vicksburg.
Okay.
Always name your scene partner after famous Civil War battles.
Right.
If you take anything from this, take that.
Yeah.
But by that time, my character has to reach out to his son.
Mm-hmm.
He's losing his son. That's what I was feeling, right? Because if he doesn't reach him now, he's never going to reach him.
Right.
Why? Because we're seeing an improv scene that these characters are going to remember 20 years from now.
Uh-huh.
I always tell my students that. Make it important, you know? So, and by the way, a lot of notes are pendulum swing notes,
mm-hmm.
and I will tell students, that's not important. Make it as important as you can. And then when they make it way too dramatic, I'll say, pull back a little bit. Go the other way around. But At that point in time, this character is losing his son. He's got to confess something to him and understand, if you go down this path, you're going to be a ladyboy. Mm-hmm. And that's what, you know, because that's what happened to me.
Right.
You know, and I think that's where it came from.
Okay. Because at that point, I'm like, okay, I don't know what's going on. I don't want to. I know that I'm intimidated by my father, so yeah. I'm going to just play the emotional, like, yeah. oh, you know. And then the ladyboy thing comes yeah. up, and then that becomes our game, basically.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. We discovered it then. Right. And it's, you know, it's a game because you know what? Not only was I a ladyboy, but I had a job as a circus monkey when I was six.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean? That's a good one.
Right.
In other words, I had all these horrible, weird jobs that you didn't know about.
Right.
You said you've always, I think.
Well, you're a successful. Pardon?
Yes, that's what it is. That was the trigger.
You're a successful businessman.
Now, I wasn't always successful.
Right.
Boom. If that, then what else did I do? If that, right. then what else did I do?
Right.
And now you're in that game.
Right, but we had plenty with just the ladyboy stuff.
Yeah,
don't you think?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we could have just stayed. Well, if that, then what else could have been all the things I did as a ladyboy?
Right.
This feels like it's turned into a different podcast totally. There are many things a ladyboy can do.
Right.
Okay? A ladyboy just doesn't clang.
Right.
I
right.
decided yeah. our ladyboy
yes.
clang.
Yes, please.
But sometimes they cook.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Sometimes they're CEOs of
yes.
you know, companies.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Have we covered our
yeah.
ass here?
No,
sometimes
much.
They become presidents
yeah.
of the United States, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
George Bush
yes.
was a ladyboy.
Yeah.
At Yale.
Yeah, right.
yeah. That's why you got C's all the
right.
time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if that, then what else is in the world of ladyboys?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, we could jump further, but I think.
And
that's
how did
it.
We discover that? That was really a nice move
yeah.
when you said you didn't really go to the game. You didn't really go to the game.
Yeah. I don't know why I didn't trust you, but I just didn't.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's because I know the exercise is a confession. And I don't want that you went to the game to be a confession because I still feel that's in the
you
rhythm.
You didn't trust me that as a player, I guess.
No, I didn't trust you as a son.
Okay.
As a player, I totally trusted you.
Mm-hmm.
I knew I could throw anything at you. That's
right.
that butter. I think we said backstage.
Well, how did you know you could trust me?
Because
we've never played before.
Yeah, I don't know. Wow, I should have thought of that ahead of time. Because I always start a scene with trust. I will trust you no matter what. I learned that from Matt Walsh. He loved to do shows of just taking somebody out on stage and just trusting them and make it. If they've never done improv, those are the people he'd want to do improv with the most.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an absolute thing of, I'm going to trust whatever you do, man, and I'm going to make you look good with
mm-hmm.
it. So that way you're not busy judging. You know, and we get in that mode when we start judging your scene partner, yourself, the suggestion, anything could turn into a judgment, and that's that spiral where you start to lose what you're focusing on in the scene.
Right.
But also, you know, I can tell you're a good improviser. You're cool.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He's cool, right? Yeah. So, yeah, it was a good scene. It was fun.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. So we're going to take some questions now from
okay.
the audience, and they've got questions.
We'll see.
Great. So we've got a question for Billy about what we just did or in general. Yes, right here?
Yeah, you mentioned that you thought it was really important to try to pull that life experience out of people to get them
yes.
on stage. Do you ever feel like there's a risk for them either alienating their team members or the audience or themselves on stage when they pull that real stuff out?
I kind of want them to feel that alienation. I want to be shooken up a little bit. That happened to me with Besser. He did a great move on us. I was just explaining this today. The very first 401 Herald team, before the Swarm, there was a team called Gigantic Man. And it was like, let's put these people in this class and turn it into a Herald team. So it was the first official class. And everybody in that team was good, but safe. Everybody was safe and kind of, we all had chops and we were playing it well. And then Besser brought in a new person to sit in with it. And the first monologue that she gave was how she won the Miss Chicago Vagina contest. And then her next monologue was talking about fisting a client. And by this time we're going, oh, no. No, this isn't. And it's like I could see Besser going, and it's like, wake the fuck up. You can't be shocked by anything. You have to accept it, you know, and want to learn more by it. I mean, remember I said pendulum swing? There comes a time when you're going, okay, dial it back. But you, yeah, I think it's great to hear those stories.
Great. Another question for Billy? Yeah, right here.
From a teaching perspective,
mm-hmm.
do you have any advice for
new improv teachers or for, as opposed to for new improvisers?
Oh, for teachers?
Yes, for teachers.
Oh, gosh, so much. Keep your class active. There's so much to say about that. I think what I said earlier, don't be too vanilla and like by good job, everybody. Of course, you want that excitement and get them to go, get everybody to feel comfortable. We do it for a very good reason, but also realize that people really appreciate the criticism when you give it to them, even if it's brand new people. I'm not saying the first day on stage you don't go, "What the fuck was that?" It's still, yes, good, good. But after a while, start to give them that, because I'm doing that now. Now, I haven't taught one-on-one in years, but because the market dictates it in LA, I'm teaching more one-on-ones and I'm having a blast doing it. And a lot of the people in class afterwards going, "Yeah, I was terrified of you, but it was the best class," you know.
What would make them terrified of you?
I think because sometimes I forget one-on-one are going out there and they're scared shitless for the first time ever, and that's why we're being very coddling.
And you're thinking, hey, maybe this is a 401 class in your head in a way, like, or they should be farther along.
Yeah, but I've always been known as the nice and fun teacher.
Right.
Like in New York, I was told, Delaney gets you in your head and Billy gets you out of your head, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of thing. Whereas as I've gotten older, I'm still that kind of fun guy, but I'm giving you critiques as if it's like, okay, this is what's wrong with that scene. I don't think you should ever walk out of one-on-one and every scene you've done is great. I don't think, how do you learn from that? You've got to, you know, learn to fail. Mm-hmm. The opposite happens in 401 at UCB, where people are so conditioned just to do everything right, they don't want to fail. And we have to teach them to fail again. We have to teach them, no, go out there, make more mistakes. Don't keep playing it safe. Don't play it close to the vest. Get out there.
But part of it must be, as they move up the level, they got pressure. Oh, I want to make a hero team.
Yeah, yeah. That's the problem with improv factories. Mm-hmm. People want to work their way up through the system to get to a thing, and they're afraid to upset the cart. And it's like, you know what? You have no control over this.
But it's interesting, because when you started, it wasn't the institution it is today.
No, it wasn't.
What is it lost because of that?
Well, first of all, as romantic as those times were, our improv was horrible, okay? The Herald teams, our first Herald teams at UCB compared to what we have now, there is no comparison. A lot of those old senior players are kind of at Herald auditions going, thank God I'm not auditioning now, because everybody's getting better and better. So it's not as romantic as that, but having said that, it's incredibly romantic and awesome, because we were just guys in an old strip club breaking down the mirrors and turning it into a, well, like this place. Isn't this used to be an erotic bookstore? I can smell it. You can smell it.
Yeah.
Right? And turned it in, and it's like, hey, guys, I got some drapes. You got a barn. Let's put on a show. And every night of the week, you're getting out there and learning to do stuff for the first time and the excitement and all that stuff. It was awesome at that time. The training program at that time wasn't a training program. It was taught. Students were called agents. And the style of improv, I think the first pamphlet, somebody showed me an old first pamphlet, was guerrilla improv techniques, as if it's in guerrilla fighting techniques. That was how it was.
That was the whole subversive,
yes,
UCB stuff.
Very subversive. And it's really funny to see how the subversive has now become the norm. You know, then what's going to be the new subversive? And blah, blah, blah. It keeps going on and on.
So what is it gain because it's an institution?
Honestly, the luxury of facilities, the ability to make players even better and better. I mean, it's capitalism of improv in a sense that because the competition is better, the people that make it up through the top are going to be that much better, you know. And you're seeing that, hopefully you're seeing that as they keep going. Also, the community is larger. You know, you don't have to be on a Herald team to succeed at UCB. And you don't have to be on a Maud team, which is their sketch program, which is going gangbusters, or their digital program, or this or that. You just have to be with like-minded people, and that's what you see, and that's kind of what's exploding that's interesting. You're being with like-minded people that have ideas, and you're doing what you want to do.
Is it kind of cool for you, because you started on the ground floor there, when and now you're in LA,
yeah,
and you're like, oh, here's Professor Billy Mary.
Yeah, that's pretty great.
I mean, honestly.
Half of it is great, of course. Everybody has an ego. There's a wonderful thing about that. The other half is like, I'm so fucking old, you know. I don't do all the improv that I want to do anymore, you know. So I'm like starting to see it. I'm not that old, but it's starting to slip away from me, that young hunger kind
of
thing.
What about, you know, and you've probably worked with tons of people that have gone on to be really successful in TV and film. How do you deal with, I was their teacher and now, you know, they got the letter and they're not even offering me a part on their TV show, for God's sake.
I would like to say that it doesn't bother me at all. Most of the time it doesn't. Other times, like I never appeared on a Nick Kroll show, and it's like, I'm not angry. It's like, I should have called him. Because I know Nick well enough to go, Nick, how come I'm not in your show? You know,
are you the type of guy who would call up and say, oh, you know, hey, Amy,
no,
I'd like to be
in
part
of the problem. I'm not that guy, but usually they'll call me in, you know, or something
for an
like
audition.
That. Yeah, yeah, or you know, I just did something on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and I didn't have to audition because they were looking for a bird expert. Mm-hmm. And, I'm the only guy at UCB that loves birds, apparently. So they brought me in. So you know. The beauty of community, just like I said about, you know, you work with the people that you want to work with. It's so huge, though, you can't remember everybody. You can't pull everybody in. When I was working on a show on MTV, I tried to bring as many UCBers as I can in. I think that's a feeling that's most people, that's the way it works.
You know? And you said to me that you were filling out something, an application for your management.
Yeah.
Can you just tell us that real quick?
When I moved over from New York to L.A., I was with a agency that is in New York and L.A., coastal, bi-coastal they call it, except, this is something I learned, L.A. doesn't like New York, I know, right? So the agencies in New York don't, or L.A. don't like the New Yorkers telling you got to make this guy get out there and do stuff. In New York, they love me, in L.A., they didn't know who I was, so they had me fill out a form of all my special talents and skills. Do you play music? Do you sing? Do you all that? It's literally, when you walk into an agency, all that stuff that you write. And under improv experience, it had three choices. Box, one of these. Either Groundlings, Second City, or IO West. And it's like there's no room for anything else. This was 6 years ago. It says, I'm with UCB. And it's like, UC what? Upright Citizens Brigade? Just say IO. I said, I'm not going to write UCB in under here. Because they had not heard of it whatsoever. Cut to last year, the head of the voiceover department, it's a huge department, called me up and asked if he could get her daughter into the advanced program. Because you have to apply to get in. So within 5 years in LA, it's turned into just ridiculous how fast it's growing. You know, and it's just weird. You know, I don't get it, but I kind of do.
What do you mean you don't get it?
I don't get how it could go that fast, how everything could turn of you simply have to be at Groundlings. You have to, oh, wait, no, did I say Groundlings? No, UCB's where you have to go. You know what I mean? So in other words, all these agents and managers say, now you got to go over here because this is the new it. This is the new thing that you have to learn. And my fear is, well, then what's going to be the next thing? Is that going to happen? Are we going to be legitimate enough to still grow and build and do our own thing, which is hopefully what we're going to do.
Well, Billy, we've got to wrap this up.
Yeah,
and this has been a blast.
Yeah.
And we ask each guest before they go one piece of advice they would give to an improviser starting out today.
Oh, you know, I got this from, I want to say I got it from Bob Dassey because I love to drop his name. I don't know if it was him or not. I just like saying his name. But if you want to be a good improviser, be a good person. And when he said that to me, I went, and it's like 20 years just washed over me. And what he's saying is, read, study, learn, live your life. My favorite note to tell young actors is like, you know what, just go to Europe, come back later, get life experiences, live your life, become a good person. That's only going to affect you better on stage. And if not, at least you've had a life, you know what I mean? That's important to me.
Great. Thank you so much. Billy Merritt, everybody. And there you have it. Another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. And I want to thank our guest from the UCB, Billy Merritt. And I loved how he broke down that scene. This guy is so passionate about improv. It was just great. And it was great to improvise with him. I want to thank Dylan Rohde and Nick Raleigh at Backline and for hosting the Omaha Improv Festival there and bringing me out there. I really, really appreciate it.
appreciate it. And thank you so much, you guys, for just treating me like a rock star. I want to thank my producer here in Chicago, Dan Schiffmacher. He is the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. Without Dan, you wouldn't be hearing my voice right now. Also, if you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning improv classes and workshops, the Artist Low Comedy, go to my website, my slick new website, jimmycorain.com. And also, sign up for my improv newsletter. Each week, I will be sending you out a new blog that will make you a better improviser and a better person. Well, the better person part is up to you. It's the same address, jimmycorain.com. As you know, we are taking over social media, and we're doing this very slowly, but it's very effective, actually. First, go to our Improv Nerd Facebook page and like us. It really helps with my low self-esteem. And then follow us over at Twitter at improv_nerd, and then check out our YouTube channel. We've got clips from the actual shows, so you can actually see people improvise and talk, and it's just so educational. We're also part of a podcast collective called feralaudio.com, so go to feralaudio.com and check out the wonderful, innovative, and hilarious podcast that they have on that we're a part of, feralaudio.com. Also, I want to thank my sponsors today, Ryan Kitley, a Chicago actor and acting coach here in Chicago. For more information about Ryan Kitley, go to ryankitley.com. It makes a big difference to have an on-camera coach before you go to an audition. Also, the 4th Annual Chicago Women's Funny Festival at Stage 773 here in Chicago, June 18th through the 21st. Go to ChicagoWomensFunnyFestival.com for more information. We'll be there, so we hope to see you there. And of course, last but not least, I want to thank you for listening. I really appreciate it, because without you, this would be nothing, absolutely nothing. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Hello, I'm Kyle Ayers. I'm the host of Never Seen It, the podcast where comedians rewrite famous movies and TV shows they've never seen, and then we give them a read in studio. This is a clip I want to play for you guys from an episode where Langston Kerman rewrites Scarface. He's never seen it, but he wrote a script based on what he thinks he knows about it, and here's a clip. Give it a listen.
All right, Scarface, The New Frontier. Interior. Happening discotheque. Remember when we called clubs discotheques? LOL. The 70s were crazy. Night. The crowd bustles with young, hot Mexicans who are supposed to be Cuban and all are dressed in butterfly collared shirts and pants that look like JNCO jeans and pleated khakis had a really weird baby. There's sex in the air and Poppy wants a whiff.
Oh my God.
Scarface, 22 to 45.
Like he's a television audience demographic.
Devilishly handsome. Not even a little bit Italian looking, so get that out of your dumb brain. Walks through the crowd with the confidence of a man who's going on MTV Cribs with the Ying Yang Twins one day. Does he actually have a scar on his face? Fuck no. Why would you even ask that? That's not important. What's important is that he is not at all a problematic stereotype and that he has come for his cocaine. As he approaches the red rope of the VIP, pronounced Ve A Pe in Spanish,
oh my God.
He spots his dear friend, who is almost certainly going to become his enemy by the end of the film, Smooth Skin. Scarface yells out his signature line.
Ciao, Bella. It's me, Scarface.